Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to the Aquarist Podcast, Episode 2. I'm really excited to say that the debut episode is doing really well on the downloads, and there have even been a couple of downloads in Canada. So very cool that I can say the show is international, at least Episode 1. In addition to iTunes and on the Aquarist Podcast website, episodes are now available via Google Play and soon to be Stitcher for all you Android users. I have a really great interview with Chance Perugini to share with this episode, but first, I want to share a little about what I have going on in my fish collection by talking about one of my five tanks. So without further ado, the first tank I want to talk about is the tank that got me back into the hobby a few months ago, a Fluval Spec 3. I sold my wife on the idea by saying that our 1.5-year-old son would really enjoy seeing a fish tank, and sure enough, he does. In the Spec 3 is a blue and red Delta beta male named Walter. Walter, because he seems grumpy, and Walter seems like a fitting grumpy name, so apologies if there's any Walters out there listening. As tank mates, he has a golden mystery snail named Frank, who's a real mover, and Blue, the blue mystery snail, who is way more snail speed than Frank. There were 7 ghost shrimp in there, but after Walter got a hold of 2 of them, I moved them out to another larger tank. For plants, it's pretty simple. 1 water sprite, 1 java fern, a moss ball, because who can keep a betta without a moss ball, and some water lettuce that propagates like crazy. We are really happy with this tank and love watching the betta and snails do their thing. I'm really most surprised by the betta. Had I known that betta fish were so enjoyable and had a lot of personality, I think I would have kept some a long time ago. And for what it's worth, I think moving forward, I feel like I'll always have at least 1 betta tank to enjoy. And now I guess the rest is history in motion. I've amassed more tanks and started a podcast to feed my tropical fish appetite, and it all started with a little Fluval Spec 3. So, on to the interview. Hello everyone, today's date is Tuesday, February the 13th. Today I'll be joined by William Chance Perugini, a pistogramma breeder, owner of the Cichlid Garden, a frequent speaker at East Coast Fish Club meetings, and contributing author to newsletters. Not to mention just being a nice enough guy to spend the next half hour of his life talking about fish with a complete stranger like me. So Chance, welcome to the Aquarist Podcast.
Thanks, man. I'm glad to be here.
Awesome. So yeah, folks, in full disclosure, Chance is currently on the road right now. He's driving home from work. We had to move the interview up today due to an urgent matter that came up. So again, Chance is all right in my book to still be able to make this happen. So from an audio perspective, you know, he's on the road. Hopefully we don't hear any horns or sirens and it's just a nice boring drive for him. But again, thank you so much, Chance, for making it.
Yeah, it's no problem. And I'm always happy to do something for the community.
Awesome. So, if you wouldn't mind, if you want to jump into your background, I mean, this is episode number 2. I would like to say that I always like to begin with understanding where my guests' background are, but you would be guest number 2. So, why don't you go ahead and kind of give us a little bit of a background on, you know, how old were you when you had your first fish tank? What are your memories? Let's talk about your progression through the hobby and kind of to where you are now.
All right. I don't really know when I got my first tank because I was just so young, and I've been keeping them since I was real young. My mom and my dad both had tanks for as far back as my memory goes. And I grew up in Houston, Texas, and I started off just catching fish in what we call the bayou, which is basically just, they're just little tiny creeks. They're ditch runoffs, basically. And there would be Texas cichlids in there, mosquito fish, which are kind of like guppies a little bit, but no color to them. There was those large green sailfin marlies, catfish of all kinds, and stuff like that. So basically, a lot of my tanks were just native Texas fish. And a lot of the times, it just ended up being only a Texas cichlid left after a while.
Yeah, so, I was going to say, how was that? I mean, that was like, you know, welcome to Thunderdome kind of action, right?
Yeah, and I was a horrible kid, and I really liked watching fish eat other fish.
Oh, no.
You know, I got away from that now. I'm not too big into that anymore, but as a child, I kind of had some sick pleasure in that, so.
Oh, man, were these guys like in a 10-gallon or something like that, or did they have...
It was horrible. I really didn't know anything about keeping fish. They were in a 20-gallon tall, like Texas cichlids and mollies and catfish and
oh man,
these mosquitoes, and they're just packed in. And then I had an under gravel filter, you know, and my dad, once in a while, he would make me clean the fish tank, and the way he would have me do it would be to just take out the take out the tank out in the yard, spray it down with a hose, put bleach in there while the fish were in a bucket, tank back up, and put all the fish back in it. And that was my cleaning.
Yeah, you know, I don't think you guys.
I never understood.
I don't think you guys were alone in that, because I remember as a kid, like, I don't think there was just much education in the mainstream of keeping fish. Like, I feel like we did really silly stuff like that with our one tank that I can recall. I know for sure we had the under gravel filter, because I vividly remember in the back corners of the tank, the charcoal, you know, at the very top of the air tube stack bubbling away, and then like a giant comet, you know, goldfish swimming in the center with a bunch of other random fish. But I mean, you know, between now and then, I mean, there's just been, just in the mainstream, like, there's so much more education, and probably things like this podcast, and maybe not this podcast at the moment, but Facebook and YouTube videos, that it's just so hard to not be educated, to know that you shouldn't do that. Where back then it was like, oopsie, look, even then I curse, so I'll go back and cut those out. But yeah, like, you just didn't know any better, and, you know, you didn't really have ill intentions.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it blows my mind that I used to bleach my filter, you know, and then just throw the fish right back in, like nothing ever happened. So I would always wonder why I lost so many fish after I cleaned the tank. But now I know better.
All right, so then you're doing Thunderdome with your Texas cichlids and catfish and various other things you're finding. You know, what's kind of your next step from there? Do you think you get a little bit more serious, or, you know, stop bleaching your tanks? Like, where are you at now?
Yeah, I think the next step was to stop bleaching the tanks, and then I think I quit for a while because I didn't have like a stable place to live at the time. I was all over the place, and then as soon as I got some more money saved up in a little bit more stable living situation, I knew I wanted to get back into the fish hobby. But I would just thought back on how I used to just keep these tiny little tanks with almost nothing. So I went the complete opposite spectrum, and I actually went full-blown saltwater. I did all this research and learned everything I could, and I actually got into clownfish breeding for quite a long time. And that was like around the time where designer clownfish was just starting. And so it was just starting to become a thing. You know, there was like two or three different types of clownfish you could get. And I really, really got infatuated with clownfish for a while because they're really goofy little fish.
So I'm going to try to create a point in time for reference. So I'm going to call it BN, and BN stands for Before Nemo, and AN for After Nemo. So is this BN or AN?
This is just before that time, just slightly before. Like, I started keeping them right before Nemo hit, and then when it did happen, my niece absolutely loved it. So she really got, she really started pushing me about getting more clownfish, and I very, very happily obliged.
Good times, yeah. So you were BN, and you were able to ride that. Nemo success wave, I guess, or that Nemo, big demand wave. All right, so saltwater, you're a salty guy at this point. Obviously, this is a freshwater podcast, so let's progress beyond your salty days. So then, what happened then? What happened with the saltwater, and how'd you get back into freshwater?
So I took a job that had me traveling the United States for work. So I would come back home frequently, but I had to leave my sister in charge of the fish tank when I was gone. And so basically what happened is I would just come home to a dead fish every single time. And it really started getting heartbreaking. So I just shut everything down and said, all right, no more until I've got a better situation for fish. So a couple years passed again, and I decided I had to, you know, I could come back to the hobby. So at that time, I was like, all right, I got to do something even more intense. and clownfish breeding, you know, I've always got to one-up myself. So I went with planted tanks. But I didn't have much space, and I had a girlfriend who was, you know, never kept a fish tank and everything. So we got a small little tank, planted it and everything, and I had to, like, half these with her. She decided that she wanted black gravel with those, like, colorful specks in it, like the pink and green. This neon and black gravel and live plants and then like fake wood ornaments. So it was like this weird Frankenstein mix, and it was a small tank, so I decided I had to have a really cool small fish in there, which turned out to be a Pistogramma cacatoides, or the triple red cacatoides.
Yeah, beautiful
fish.
Which
you see pretty frequently. And that was it, man. I got those, and I fell right back into my breeding habits, and I just fell in love with the entire genus.
All right, so I'm going to pause you right there, and I'm going to go back now. I'm going to reference an article that you wrote. I'm going to mess up the newsletter that this particular article published in, but you wrote an article called I Hated Cichlids. So how did you, somebody that hated cichlids, now you're telling me you've got a cacatoides in there. So what was that about?
All right, so we used to go to the fish store, and I liked cichlids as a kid, but that was the problem. I went from, you know, Texas cichlids murder and everything, and then for a while before I got rid of my tanks, I had African cichlids, and they're just jerks and beat the crap out of each other. And my dad had Oscars and, you know, all those big South American and Central American cichlids, and so I've been around that my whole life, and they're just mean fish, you know. Well, not all of them, obviously, but there's exceptions. But mostly, they're just jerks, you know. They bite your hand, or they'll eat your fish. You know, you can't have anything nice around them because they break it. And I just hated them. I thought they were so stupid, and I wanted nothing to do with cichlids. And when I got this small tank, I did all this research trying to find a fish. And it kept leading me back to cichlids. And I kept saying, well, I don't want cichlids, though. So I did a bunch of research, and I finally figured out that these opisthos are not going to be huge jerks. They're not going to tear my tank apart. You know, they're not going to do all those things that I hated about cichlids. They're actually pretty peaceful fish. And they're not going to eat other fish. And so I said, well, let me give it a shot. And I go and I tell my girlfriend, and she said, but you told me those are, I call them a-hole fish. And she said, you told me cichlids are a-hole fish. And I said, well, yeah, but, you know, and this one's different. And so I've never lived that down. Still to this day, when I talk about opisthos, she said, yeah, but those are a-hole fish. And she won't let it go. She hates opisthos, and she hates cichlids because I wouldn't let her have all the cichlids she wanted when we started.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say, you know, my first foray into keeping tropical fish on my own outside of what I had when I was a little kid, you know, my 125-gallon had a couple Oscars in it, and I don't know, just I guess at the time around 2006, 2007, there wasn't as much YouTube, not as much resources as there are now, so I didn't even know about the Epistogramma, and, you know, I'm not saying that I was doing all sorts of cichlid research, but just that name never came up in anything that I was ever looking at or reading, and then this time getting into the hobby and wanting to do more of a community tank and this 75-gallon that I have in the fish room, and you know, coming across the Epistogramma and watching some videos and species profiles, I'm like, yeah, that's a cool fish. And I think the one that really caught my attention was a cacatoides in the store. I mean, that sucker was gorgeous. It, you know, how small it was, and it was planted tank friendly. So, I have a male female. I think they're a pair. They don't hate each other, but you know, I haven't exactly you know, seen if they're in love with each other or not. But it's the Epistogramma borelli, the opal. In both, I mean, the male is absolutely gorgeous, and the female, she's a looker too. So I am very, very happy with them, and they seem to be liking the planted tank so far. So yeah, I mean, you know, at this point now, I'm gonna be selfish here, and you know, sure, I'm interviewing you, but at the same time, I'm gonna learn about Epistogrammas from you.
I'm more than happy to answer any questions. I really enjoy Epistos, and I've kept a lot of species. I mean, I've bred like, I don't even know, 15 or 20 species. So I research a lot, and I actually owned a lot. So I'm happy to answer whatever you got.
So I guess let's hit the let's just hit that species basics, right? So you know, food, substrate, plants, temperature. What are kind of the basics, you know, starter pack for somebody wanting a pair with a pistogramma or a trio? I've read in some certain species can do that male to female trio.
Yeah, trios work pretty good. I generally keep just pairs because you know, it's just more competition, and they start to fight with each other if you don't give them a big enough tank. I err on the side of caution and like to go with bigger tanks. So I keep pairs, and usually at 20 long. Let's see. With a pistos, it's about footprint. So you want to have a larger footprint of a tank. That's why I go with 20 longs. You got 30 inches by 12, which is a good amount of space for a full-grown, fully adult pair, in my opinion. You can keep younger or smaller trios in a 20 long, but I feel like when they get to full size, then it gets a little too small. Especially you start having babies, the females turn on the male, and they start getting aggressive, and the male's got nowhere to go at that point. So that's just my personal preference. Some people will tell you, will swear by some, you know, smaller tanks or whatever, but that's what I like to do. I like to err on the side of caution.
And
as for sub,
yep. You're actually about to start getting into substrate.
Yep. All right. So substrate, sand, because they are actually sifters. They're somewhat related to geophagus, you know, and you know, geophagus like to dig. Well, pistos do too. They like to dig in the sand, and they actually sift the sand through their gills. So you want to have a fine grain sand because they need it for sifting their gills. Think of it kind of like a toothbrush. The sand passes over their gills, cleans it, gets any parasites, anything off like that. So I really like to urge people to look into a fine grain sand, something that they can easily sift through their gills. Let's see, what else? Oh, they're cave spawners. So if you want them to even feel comfortable in your tank, not even just spawn, but just feel comfortable, you really need to have lots and lots of little hiding spots, little caves. The females actually like to choose caves that the male can't even fit in. They'll tend to choose a cave with the smallest possible opening. And then a lot of times they'll even pile up sand in front so that they can barely squeeze inside. So the more caves you have in that tank, the better, the more comfortable your fish are going to be. And even though it's counterintuitive, the more they can hide, the more likely you are to start seeing them. Whenever you leave your tank too open, they're going to start being a lot more bashful. Let's see, what else? They like acidic water. Alkaline, even just a moderately hard water is not really that great for them. But you can keep them at around a pH like Borelli, Cockatoides, McMasteri, a lot of these tank strains. They do good in the 7 pH range, but you don't want to go too far. You're going to start running into health issues with them, but you can always go lower. So, I mean, I've had fish that certain species I've kept as low as a pH of 3, but, you know, that's pretty extreme. A pH of 5 is good, and 6 is good, you know, for most species.
Yeah, man, those are really, really good tips. I mean, first off, to go back and talk about the substrate, one, I can check the box. I've got pool filter sand, so you're making me feel good already in that tank, so I'm going to help take care of them toothbrush style on their gills. But yeah, I mean, I have not read or heard that one yet as far as like which substrate, and certainly like to help them, you know, be healthier and keep their gills clean. The second part on the caves, now I've seen the little apisto huts, but to hear your feedback as somebody that's bred them, you know, the more caves, the merrier, smaller opening, the better. Right now I've got, I went on Amazon and bought a couple of those like terracotta steaks that have a closed end. I think they're more pleco style.
Yeah.
But other than that, I mean, I tend to find that these apistos, mine are hiding in the Windelov. I think it's Java for Windelov. So they're always hanging out in there. They're definitely on like the bottom 25% of the water column. So let's talk those terracotta apisto huts that I can buy online, or like a do-it-yourself coconut hut, or just in general, like if it's not one of those two, like what do you like for the huts for the apistogrammas?
A lot of times what I do is I go to the store and get coconuts because they're cheap. And what I do is I take a drill bit that's around, I want to say, I think I use half inch, but it might be 3/4. It depends on the fish. What I try to do is look at my female and I try to pick a bit size that's like barely going to let her squeeze in, you know? And then what I do is I drill the hole right in the side of the coconut, the whole coconut. Drill into it, and you know, you're going to pop it, and all the coconut flesh and the water is all going to be inside. And then I drain the water, and then I break the coconut in half right along that hole. So that puts the hole half, like a half hole on the bottom edge of two halves of a coconut, if that makes any sense at all.
No, totally. And is that the only hole then?
Yeah, and
oh, wow.
So then it's just two halves with just a half hole on the bottom of that coconut, so that the and then I place them on the sand. So then you kind of get two caves out of one coconut, and a small little hole on the sand where she can either dig if she needs the hole bigger, or bury if she wants the hole smaller, you know. And that gives her that kind of a flexibility with how she wants the cave to be. And they always seem to go for those coconuts. Like, I had a lot of luck with coconuts. I also look for pieces of driftwood, too, because you can get crevices and cracks and holes all through driftwood. And so, you know, they'll go right into those, too. Some females prefer driftwood. Some like the coconuts. You know, it's all over the place.
Wow. I mean, so I guess with the – as far as drill size, I mean, maybe you could initially start with the smallest hole that you think would work, and then if your pisto is kind of ignoring it, then maybe you could pull that coconut back out and then ream that hole a little bit larger, you know, until you find that sweet spot, as opposed to, you know, hey, I started too large, and you know, you can't really add coconut back to it. So I definitely after this call, I think I'm gonna go run down to my local grocery store and see if we have any coconuts here in Seattle. So
yeah, and they usually
they're
usually like a buck something for a coconut, if I remember correctly. So I mean, I'm always trying to do things as cheap as possible, because I just set up so many tanks, you know.
Yeah, and for
you get to a point where you have to go.
Yeah, cheap. Yeah, and for those listening, I mean, there's like 1.5 million YouTube videos on cutting coconuts and doing this. I don't think they've taken your strategy though of drilling the hole along the equator of the coconut, for lack of a better term. And then cracking it halfway so that you have the hole towards the bottom. I think a lot of them, they show the hole towards, like, somewhere towards the, more middle portion after you crack it in half. So that's that sounds like a pro tip right there. I'm definitely going to try that out. And then you just threw the coconut in there. Did you ever try to super glue any pieces of plant on there just to give it a little bit more cover?
A lot of times I don't like to use super glue, because sometimes it kills the plant, or, you know, I run into issues with super glue. I do it sometimes, but usually my default go-to is fishing line. I usually use fishing line to tie things to it. I seem to have better luck with tying stuff on with fishing line.
Yeah, I've done 50-50 right now. I've done some Java moss with fishing line, and not just fishing line, but fluorocarbon, right? So, I mean, if you're a fisherman like me,
you get that
invisible fluorocarbon, you'll never see it in the water. And I've also done super glue, but then I did notice that the Java fern, it looked like it died off where I super glued it. And it's been about 3 weeks, and now it's finally starting to go green. So I thought I almost killed my Java fern for a little bit there.
Yeah, it tends to recover, but you're right. It does die, and I just don't like doing that. I'd rather it just stay alive all the time rather than make a comeback later. You know?
Java fern is not—it's not cheap right now. I mean, it's a pretty expensive plant for the small portion that you get for, you know, $5 if you're buying it from another hobbyist, you know, and if you're even able to get it in the stores, you know, it's like golf ball for $10. So Java fern's not cheap.
Yeah.
All right, so I've got my substrate, I've got a temp, I've got pH, I've got my huts. I'm in a 20 long with my pair. So what else do I need to do to set the mood? I mean, is pellet food good enough? Are you supplementing with anything else?
When I was really into breeding, I was using basically all frozen and live foods, nothing else. They are not carnivores, I guess. What do they call microvores? They basically eat all living animals in the wild, you know, and they get a mix of detritus in their gut with that stuff, which makes up some bit of plant matter in their diet. But for the most part, they prefer some sort of living protein. So they need, first off, a really high protein diet. So if you are going to go pellet, flake, make sure whichever you pick is really high, like 60% or better on protein. But if you're really trying to go into the breeding, you should really look into live and frozen foods. I mean, I just go in and I buy whatever I can get my hands on. Rhesus shrimp, bloodworms, black worms, mosquito larvae, all kinds of stuff, and just try to mix it up and feed them, give them a varied diet so I never feed the same thing 2 days in a row. But that's basically what I do. In the summer, I set out a bin of water and just let it sit and collect mosquito larvae almost every day. And if you don't have too many tanks, then that works really well. But once you get up to like 40-something tanks, you start running low on mosquito larvae pretty quick.
I wonder if your county vector control agency was flying over your house and dropping any of that mosquito killer with your operation you got going on.
What I actually did too is sometimes if it gets warm enough, I just throw a couple of pistos into those bins, and so they keep it under control, and then I net whatever's left. So I usually work out without adding too many mosquitoes. But just don't tell your significant other you set up a mosquito breeding habitat in the backyard.
Well, duly noted. I'll take your advice on that one for sure. All right. Let's see here. So, other than the mosquitoes, did you do like a brine shrimp? Did you culture your own brine shrimp at all?
Brine shrimp are such a pain. I hate doing brine shrimp because they, if you feed adult brine shrimp, I think you got to gut load them, and then, then there's salt water, so you got to do all this crap with salt water. What I do, I do as much live stuff as I can. I have live blackworms, live this, live that. I have copepod cultures and all kinds of different cultures. But I try to just find things that I don't have to do any work on. And for as far as like, a lot of people hatch baby brine shrimp for feeding fry. I just went with microworms, which are a lot easier in my opinion, but a little smellier.
Okay, good to know. Yeah, good disclaimer there. Easier but smellier. So, all right, let's talk age. At what age, I mean, if I got my epistos from a fish store, my local fish store, maybe a month and a half ago now, obviously these things aren't, super mature. When would you expect them age-wise to be mature to start breeding?
When you get them at your fish store, they're already breeding. They can start breeding before you can even really reliably sex them. So I've had fish that I thought might be male and female, I'm talking fish maybe total length a half inch, and I've had them breed before. Now that's really early, obviously, but it's possible at that small of a size. So by the time you get your hands on the fish, it's almost positive they can breed already. Unless you're buying fry,
Okay, good to know. And let's talk signs of breeding, right? So, I've got a male-female pair. I get my coconut huts in there. Like, what are the signs I guess I could expect to see in your experience? Or, oh, man, these guys are, they're getting ready.
All right, so what I would say to look for when your pair starts thinking about breeding, your female's going to start turning kind of yellow and black. That'll be the first thing to look for. If she starts getting a little bit of yellow color to her, that means she might have interest in the male.
Is that specific to my opals, or is that just opistos in general?
That's all opistos.
Okay. Yellow and black.
Females go yellow and black. So then you might start seeing the female likes to show her belly kind of to the male. Like when she is ready to breed and she wants him to follow her back to the hut, she'll kind of turn sideways in front of him and say, like, look at my belly kind of move. And then she'll try to guide him back to her little cave or hut or wherever she wants him to go, at which point, you know, they'll spawn. So that's a really good sign. That means the female is really really interested in the male. That means she's ready to breed, ready to go. All he has to do is go with her. Now, after that, you'll see, after the spawning takes place, you'll generally see a female start acting more aggressive and doing kind of like a tail slap, where she might swim up in front of the male and like turn her back to him and then swing her tail in his direction, kind of like slapping water at him towards his face. And that would generally be saying, okay, the female has eggs already somewhere in the tank, and she's guarding them. She doesn't want him near them. So if she's doing that, you should watch back to where she swims to after doing that to him, because there's probably eggs there.
Okay, nice. And then so once you start seeing that behavior, typically when can we expect those eggs to hatch and fry to be in the tank?
So eggs from laying to hatching usually take 7 days. It can take 6 or it can take 8, but almost always 7. And once they are laid, they'll hatch, and then they take a few more days before the fry start. Or no, actually, no. I think they hatch in like 3 days, and then it takes 4 days for them to swim. Something like that. I'm fuzzy on the numbers at the moment, but in total, it'll take about 7 days for the fry to start exploring the tank. So at about 7 days, 8 days sometimes, she takes them on their first little trip around the tank, and you'll see mama usually sitting right over the top of a huge cloud of them. And they kind of just sit on the bottom and flip around every once in a while. And then it'll take a few more days after that for them to actually start being good swimmers.
Awesome. And now for what's an average size of fry that you can expect? I mean, if you've ever gotten your microscope and counted them, what's a good number to expect? And then I guess maybe for me personally, like the first time, you know, if I'm able to successfully get them to breed and have fry, like what kind of numbers can I expect? I'm not asking to count my chicken, you know, count dollar bills or anything like that. just to know, like, hey, you know, that was normal. All right.
So, it's different for every species, but in particular, Borelli has a huge spawn. So your Borelli, they're going to have very, very large spawns with very slow-growing fry. So you might be waiting a while to count those dollar bills. But as far as getting the fry size, I would say you'll probably be looking at anywhere from 100 to 200 fry on a Borelli batch.
Wow. And how many, what's the survival rate of that like?
It varies. See, that just comes into how you care for your fry. I like to leave mine with the parents. It's less work on my end. And, you know, to me, it's more natural for the fish. So that's my preference. But it also does lead to higher depth. So with that, you may be looking at 50 to 75% live. So maybe 25 to 50% death, you know. As far as,
and is that if I pull them or if I leave them in the tank?
Yeah, if you pull them, what you can do is you can pull them before they ever even hatch, you know, and pull them as soon as you see the eggs laid, put them in a specific fry tank, keep the water pristine and all that stuff. I mean, you can get really, really high survival rates. I mean, you can get in the 90% easily. So, I mean, it just depends on how you want to go about doing it.
Yeah, yeah. Personally, it sounds like, you know, leaving them with the mom and just seeing, you know, the mom shepherd around that little cloud of fry around the tank sounds pretty awesome to experience.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun watching their behavior. I really like leaving them with the parents and letting them grow up to kind of with the parents to get that natural instinct in them and everything. You know, that's my preference. But if you're really going for, you know, if you really want to try and sell as many as you can, then, you know, you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah, just disclaimer for everyone out there, I am not, you know, I don't think I have the skill set to be a professional breeder. So, I mean, if I'm successful, I mean, they're either going to go to my local fish store for some credit or, you know, auction at my local fish club. So I just want to be successful and see some cool fry swimming around. So, I mean, so then at what point then, size-wise, should I be pulling the fry or I guess the adolescent opistos at this point? From a, you know, and to know that, okay, these guys are ready, we're going to start having maybe aggression issues in the tank and things like that, like a kind of repeat of Thunderdome.
All right. So I would say probably you have a month. And after a month, that's where the female is going to start looking to spawn again. But you have to keep in mind that's like an estimate. Some females go sooner, some go later. I've had females that would raise batches of fry all together. Like, they'd have a batch of fry, 3 weeks later have another batch, and just protect them from the old batch, but not any aggression issues. And I had one that had three generations grow up together. I had another female, however, that she would spawn every 2 weeks, and after 2 weeks, she would eat all the fry in the tank and then lay another batch that day. So if I didn't have those fry out in time, they were all gone. She would eat every single one of them while I was at work. And so that was pretty frustrating. Then there's other ones, you know, that just, they won't spawn again until the fry are pulled. And, you know, you just got to watch the fish. The female will start showing an interest in the male again. And when you start seeing that, you'll know it's time to get them out of there.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, so, I mean, definitely I'm going to have to keep my eye on and eye on these guys, and you know, my miles will vary, but I mean, the insight that you've provided, I mean, just awesome information packed, a ton of things that I've written down, not just for like notes for us to talk about stuff, but like Randy needs to do these things if he wants to be successful and have some cool little pieces of swimming around his tank. So I definitely thank you for that. Let's talk about what you have going on in the future. Like, what's, cause I know right now, well, we didn't say it in the beginning, but you're taking a little bit of a hiatus from the Cichlid Garden page. So, the Facebook page is up. So if listeners, if you go check it out, just go look at it for, you know, just to give his page a view, but just know that you're not actually moving epistos on that page right now. But what do you have in the works?
Let's see, right now I'm tending a couple tanks. My girlfriend has some endlers and stuff and some quarries and some tanks that she wants. So I just kind of take care of them for right now. I have plants just stuffed in tank upon tank upon tank, because at some point I'm going to get back into this episto thing, and I don't want to have to go buy all new plants because they're expensive. So for right now, I'm just kind of trying to figure out some other aspects of my life. And I felt like water changes and all that stuff was taking up way too much time. So I still speak at clubs. I still like to be involved in the hobby. I still go to meetings. I still go to local events. And I still try to keep up with people. But I'm just not keeping any fish of my own right now. I'm just, like I said, watching the girlfriend's fish, basically. So, you know, I would say probably within a year or two, I'll be looking to maybe start getting tanks back up again and maybe start the Cichlid Garden back up and everything. But for right now, I just kind of need time is too important for me right now, so I'm just trying to step back a little bit.
No, totally. Yeah, and I mean, you know, again, the fact that you're taking some of that precious time to even talk to me, and hopefully in the meantime, between, you know, while you're taking your sabbatical, if you will, from the Cichlid Garden, that you know, just the information that you shared with me alone, and then, you know, if anybody else listening to this can, you know, be successful at raising epistos and have fun and just spread the spread this cool fish around the hobby, you know, mission accomplished, man. I mean, thank you very much. You piqued my interest. So what's your one favorite plant to put in an episto tank?
Let's see, there's a lot. I really like crips. but I also like dwarf Sagittarius. I forget. I'm not sure on the exact pronunciation, but it's like Sagittarius subulata, something like that. And I like that one a lot because it carpets, but it's not difficult to keep. And I really just like the look of crypts when they get really full. Those are probably my two favorites.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you very much. Yeah, and so for what it's worth, I mean, Chance, when you do pick things back up with the cichlid garden, I mean, let me know. I'll give you a shout out, and you know, hopefully, if that gives it a little, you know, boost, or you know, wherever we're at with this podcast in the future, I'd be more than happy to do that. So just reach out to me. Yeah, and I mean, I thank you very much for your time. The insight that you've shared with us is just valuable, super valuable. And it's just been great talking with you, Chance. So thank you so much, and yeah, I hope you have a safe rest of your drive, and enjoy the rest of your week, man.
Yeah, no problem, man. Like I said, my biggest goal with the cichlid garden was just to get more people to keep opisthos. So if this helps in any way, you know, I'm happy to still do what I can. That's why I still speak at meetings and stay involved, because really my only goal is just to have you guys keep an opisthos.
Thank you very much again, Chance. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
All right, take care now.
All right, you too.
Thank you, everyone, for listening into this episode. It was great connecting with Chance and learning a ton about Opisthogrammus. If you haven't already done so, please subscribe and leave a comment about the podcast so others can find it. And go ahead and be super fish nerds and share the podcast on your social feeds. I certainly appreciate the shares. Find the show on Facebook and Instagram at Aquarius Podcast. And lastly, feel free to suggest someone that you think would be great as an interview subject as well. I will happily work through a backlog of people to interview if it means consistent episode releases chalked with great content. Thank you again. Until next time.